Inform Podcast, episode number 28. I am one of your hosts, Neil, and with me is the cat's meow of the podcasting world, my co-host, Jared. Say hi, Jared.
Hi, Neil. You know, I've started calling myself the cat's meow in regular parlance, too. So I've got that going for me.
That's good. That's good. I actually, the reason I think I started to say that and then I've just kept saying it is that one of the other podcasts that I listen to, this is a podcast I listen to when I want to, like, I do it when I run, actually, because, like, I listen to some heavy podcasts that are really good, like, kind of get you thinking podcasts, like Why Theory does that, and the Machinic Unconscious Happy Hour does that, and Red Library does that, and The Regrettable Century, like, those get me thinking. Yeah, but sometimes I don't want to think a lot about what I'm listening to. I just want to kind of have something that I can sort of like listen to and sort of tune into and tune out of. As I'm doing something like running, which is a really big one where I'll do this. And I listen to a different podcast called EPL Podcast, which is English Premier League. So it's a podcast about the English Premier League. And one of the hosts of that podcast calls himself the bee's knees of the football podcasting world. And it's I've always said, I listened to that, I think, the first time I said that about you, I'd listened to that podcast shortly before. And so It was in my mind. So that's where it comes from.
That's why it came up. Okay.
But regardless, you know, you are the cat's meow of the podcasting world. So that's a thing you should, if you ever have to do, like, you know, hello, my name is tags, you should write that on there or something like that. You can put it on your CV. Cat's meow of the podcasting world.
Oh, yeah, for
world.
Sure. I've mentioned that I ride a motorcycle, so I'll get a patch that says the cat's meow and put that on my motorcycle jacket.
Perfect. Perfect. So what are we talking about today? What's the topic of conversation for today's particular episode of Inform?
So we still have a bit of residue from the Demand versus Desire episode, sort of mini-series kind of that we've been doing here. And the leftover that we have right now is the subject of the statement and the subject of the enunciation. For at the end of our last podcast, we had wanted to transition to that and then decided it was probably too big a box to open to also tack on to that single episode. So we're doing a separate episode that's on these two different things.
Right. So that the last episode started out, we talking about demand and desire and the transition from demand to desire. And we talked about the graph of desire and the retroactivity in that graph. And even though I don't think either of us planned for it, but whatever, we ended up talking about therapeutic interventions more than about the graph of desire and more about that, about like these kind of concepts that you come across if you do a lot of reading or research into the graph of desire, the subject of the statement, the subject of the enunciation. So what I want to do here now is kind of kick this over to you and ask you, like, orient the listener here. Talk about the subject of the statement. Talk about the subject of the enunciation. Try to, in your own words, you know, get people to understand, if they don't already, what those two terms mean to you.
Sure. When we produce speech, it has more than one aspect to it. If Freud was talking about it, he might call it the manifest content of the speech and the latent content of the speech. And Lacan makes this same sort of delineation, what he calls the subject of the statement and the subject of the enunciation, which is meant to sort of illuminate these dual aspects of our speech when we produce it. The subject of the statement is sort of what we're consciously attempting to say to another person when we produce speech. It's the actual, like, sort of literal content of the words that we have said without regard for the other side of the coin, which is the subject of the enunciation, which is the unconscious, the latent content that makes itself known from the speech that we produce. You've used, when you were doing the first season of this podcast, where you were talking on your own into a microphone, the example of a really simple statement, I'm fine. You can say those two words and the literal content, the manifest content of those words, it has the meaning, but the enunciation, the manner in which they're spoken, makes something unconscious known through the act of enunciating. So you have the subject of the statement, the words written down on a piece of paper that say, I'm fine. And you have the subject of the enunciation, which is the, maybe the manner in which you've said the words, I'm fine. you can imagine that statement being almost completely straightforward, like, I'm fine, I'm not great, I'm not bad, I'm fine, I'm in the middle. You can imagine it being sort of scornful, almost like, I'm fine, like, leave me alone, go away, or something like that. You can imagine it being taken a myriad of different ways.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because I don't think I talked about this when I did the episode in season one, but tell me if I did. I use that statement. There's I'm a fan of the TV show Doctor Who, and one of my favorite people to play the part of the Doctor is David Tennant. He played the 10th Doctor, for anybody who cares. And my favorite companion of his time on Doctor Who was Donna Noble, who was played by Catherine Tate. And there's this one episode of the show where, like, they've gone on a romping adventure somewhere and, you know, saved the universe from bad things or whatever. But things don't quite work out so well in the end, right? They save the day, but there's a cost to it, right? There's this cost that they have to pay to save the day. And they're kind of standing, you know, at the end of the episode, and the Doctor is looking kind of like off into the middle distance, somewhat mournfully. And Donna Noble says to him, "Are you okay?" And he goes, "Yeah, of course I'm okay. I'm fine, you know, whatever." And she says, "Is I'm okay Time Lord for I'm not okay at all?" And he says, "Why do you ask?" And she says, "Because I'm okay too." And I thought that that was a great example of this kind of like dichotomy between the subject of the statement and the subject of the enunciation. It's awesome, right? It's this, in this instance, the Doctor says, "I'm okay, I'm fine." And then what his companion does is describe the subject of the enunciation. Are you saying, when you say you're okay, when you say you're fine, is that your way of saying that you're not fine at all? That you're actually in a really bad way? You know, he still gets dodgy, and he's like, you know, "Why would you ask?" And she says, "Because I'm okay too." It was great. It's such a nuanced but simplistic kind of conversation, right? Like, there's not tons of big words being used here. They're not diving into, you know, the depths of psychological theory and pulling out all sorts of interesting conceptual signifiers to describe what's happening here. But something interesting happens in that particular dialogue.
It's interesting. I've never seen the episode that you're talking about. So the way that you've described it is the only way that I'm familiar with it at all. And it's interesting that you described it first as like a translation, like she translated the subject of the statement into the language of the subject of the enunciation, like almost as if they're two completely separate languages, which in a way they kind of are.
Yeah, definitely. I know sometimes when I teach about this, I'll tell a story. When I was in college, I was dating somebody, and I went to community college before I went off to a 4-year university for 2 years. So this is when I was in community college. I'm living at home. My girlfriend is also living with her parents. And one day I was like, class had just wrapped up, and I was going to go see her, and I was going to go see her at her parents' house. I think our plan was like that we were going to study. Maybe we weren't going to study, but we were saying we were going to study. I don't know. And on the way there, I got something to eat from a fast food place, right? So I was like, I was hungry. I got some fast food, and then I drive to my girlfriend's house, you know, knock on the door. Her parents let me in. They're Polish, actually. They were Polish immigrants, her family. Her parents came here from Poland when she was, I think, in the 8th grade. And they're very, very hospitable, her parents, right? Like they want to give you food, and they want to talk to you. So, you know, we're doing whatever. And here's another thing that's important to know for this story. My girlfriend was a smoker. She smoked. And she was under the impression that her parents didn't know that she smoked. Like, she thought that she was like keeping this a big secret. And the thing is that both of her parents, both of them, had said to me at different times, like, they'd say, I'm not going to use her name here, but they'd say, like, does she smoke? And her mom asked me that one time first. And she asked me in the presence of like my girlfriend and her father. And her dad like looked at his at the mom, and he's like, "Don't ask him that. You cannot ask him that right now." You know, and so she was like, "No, no, I want to know." And her dad's saying like, "You don't have to answer her. You don't have to answer her." And then he like does the thing where he like kind of like puts a hand to the side of his mouth, and he's just like we know she smokes, you know, and all that. So it's like they knew that she smoked, but there was this like big elaborate like. She would say, "No, I don't smoke. I just like I was sitting in the smoking section because there were smoking sections at this time, mm-hmm. or you know, my friends were smoking and I was around them, and that's why I smell like smoke or whatever, and all that." So this is all going on, and I've left class and I've gotten something to eat. And now I've ended up at my girlfriend's house, and she says to me, "Do you want to go out and get something to eat?" And at the right away, I say to her, "No, I actually grabbed food on my way down," and she looks at me and she goes, "Fine," and she says it like that, you know, like with like ice daggers, and I'm like, do you want to go get something to eat? And she goes, no, I'm fine. And I'm like, oh, this isn't good. And her dad's like looking at me, and like there's this like between him and me, like, oh, you just did something really dumb, like, you fool. And I'm like shrugging, and he's like shrugging back, like, I don't know how to help you, man. You know, so all this stuff is going down. And, you know, I'm going to fast forward. Eventually, like, we were talking away from her parents, and she's like, "Let's study." And I'm like, "Oh, okay. Are you mad at me?" And she's just like, "Why would I be mad at you?" And I'm like, "I don't know why you would be mad at me. Actually, I'm very confused. You seem like you're very mad, and I don't know what I did." And, she's like, "Don't worry about it." So I was like, all right. So I'm like feigning, like I'm studying with her. Some time goes by, and eventually she like looks up and she's like, "Do you really not know why I'm mad at you?" And I was like, "I really don't know why you're mad at me. I'm truly like, I'm sorry. I don't know, but I don't know why you are angry." And she says, "You should have known that when I said, 'Do you want to get something to eat?' that was my way of trying to get out of this house so that I could go somewhere where I could smoke a cigarette. And I couldn't say that because my parents were there, obviously. And you just should have understood that when I looked at you and said, 'Hey, do you want to go get something to eat?' that I don't care if we get food, you know, like that doesn't matter. I just wanted to go somewhere and smoke." And I was like, "Oh, I didn't know that I took you at the subject of the statement."
Yeah, exactly.
You know, not the subject of the enunciation, which was a totally different thing that she was getting at. And she was really angry at me because when you're, you know, in a romantic relationship with somebody, I think to some degree they suspect and expect that you will understand their subject of the enunciation more often than most people will. So that's my story.
It makes sense. I think you probably, maybe not, I don't know. It's certainly in my own experience, though, I've become more familiar with the... when my wife is trying to enunciate versus when she's trying to state. So I don't know, maybe there's something to that the more that time goes on, the more familiar you become with these two different subjects, these two different aspects of speech.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, we've talked in our previous episodes a lot about the role of the analyst, right? Like that's been one of our recurrent themes, I think, in many episodes. I think you could say that one of the ways you could cast the role of the analyst is somebody who's really good at tuning into the subject of the enunciation, regardless of whatever the subject of the statement is.
Right. Yeah, we've talked about how the analyst is sort of a secretary of the unconscious. They're sort of writing down what comes up in between the lines, sort of the speech of their patient. And this is another good way to think of it, that we can sort of set aside to some level the statements in and of themselves in favor of the enunciations of our patients.
For sure. So that's actually, I think, a really good way to describe this, right? The subject of the speech versus the subject of the enunciation is that... if you're performing the role of the analyst as the secretary of the unconscious, what you are doing is you're attempting to write down the subject of the enunciation, not literally, like you're not sitting there as your person speaks with a pen writing down on like a legal pad or something like that. But I guess I would say you're noting or you're highlighting the subject of the enunciation that's going on here. Now, of course, you do all of that through the subject of the statement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you work with the speech that the analysand produces, but in working with it, what you're doing is you're kind of noting, highlighting, calling attention to specific elements of that speech, and in so doing, trying to, get the subject of the enunciation to be a little bit more present in the experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right that the you can't have the enunciation without the statement, obviously, right? It mm-hmm. goes back to what we talked about on our last episode a little bit about the retroactivity. I think the enunciation doesn't become clear until after the speech has been produced. And at that point, it can be examined and highlighted so that we can bring forth the unconscious material of the speech produced.
As you say that, one of the ways that a kind of thought that comes to my mind here is that, you know, the person makes a statement, they tell you a story, they tell you a joke or whatever they say. That's the subject of the statement, right? There's been speech which has been produced. I kind of think maybe one way out of so many ways you could imagine the subject of the enunciation is that there's going to be like a ghost that kind of like lingers and haunts the space that exists sort of like only after the statement has been made, right? The enunciation is this kind of like there, but not really there. This, present absence, absent presence thing that is there, but it's also not, right? That's the subject of the enunciation. What do you think of that?
It makes me think that this is maybe a slightly different topic, but I think it comes together here that the reason we have these ghosts, that we have desire, that we have an unconscious in the first place is because of the enunciation in speech, right? Am I making sense? Does that make sense to you that we're...
Say more
we're
about
sort
it.
Of, yeah, that we're... That we're pierced by speech, that the mismatch between what is said and what is enunciated is what gives way to the existence of desire in the first place. You say, like, I want an apple, and that's the statement. The enunciation, though, is Todd McGowan puts it really well in writing in his book Capitalism and Desire. He goes that with speech, you move from wanting an apple to wanting an air quotes apple. I think it's a really great way to demonstrate what I'm trying and maybe failing to get at here, that apple stops being the manifest object of an apple, and like you're holding an apple and you can take a bite of an apple. Like it moves on from that and moves into a myriad of different things.
Mm, yeah. Oh, it's like the ideal of it is what you're
right,
looking
right.
for. Yeah. Which of course you're not going to get.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. All you're ever going to be able to get is like an apple, not the apple.
Yeah. That does make sense. So another thing about this though, that I think is important to look at here is that we talk about the subject of the statement and the subject of the enunciation. I'm trying to like italicize in the way I say it, the word subject of, because there's this idea that there's a statement. And when you said we're pierced by it, right? Like that's what made me think of this. So there's the we are subjected to statements, but we're also subjected to enunciations. Mm-hmm. I think another way to maybe to describe that is to say that we are subjects to, you know, what somebody says or what we say, and we're also subjects to kind of the ghosts that haunt what it is that is said, right? We're subjected to both of those things. And sometimes they kind of like, when Lacan talks about a split subject, I think this is what he's getting at, right? Like there's the subject is split. And on one side, you have the statement, and on the other side, you have the enunciation. And we're subjected to both of these things simultaneously, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's not like you're subjected to one, and then, like, only afterwards, like, are you subjected to the other? Although we're talking about the retroactivity, so it might seem that way. I think the idea is that they happen close enough to each other, right? like the statement is completed and then, you know, so it's done. The statement isn't being made anymore. It has been made. The making of the statement is now in the past, and the enunciation ghost shows up and starts haunting whatever space is there now. This all happens kind of simultaneously, and we're subjected to that. So what are your thoughts on this idea of the subject, right? Which is a huge, huge, huge concept, right? Like, I mean, we could, that's something we could probably talk more in depth about on its own episode, is what is the subject. But for now, like, let's just kind of like talk about it a little bit.
Sure. I think maybe a good way to start is with the sort of the common understanding of what subject is, what subjectivity is. And it's, I mean, you're, I'm sure, familiar with the way that people have conceived of the word subject for a long time. And it's the opposite of objectivity. Like, it's this idea that we bring something to the table more than just like the strictly manifest content. Like, I'm doing a poor job of explaining myself. So if you, the way that it's come up for me in my education is when you're talking about research, you talk about the objective parts of research, like the behavior of rats in a lab. They're not subjective creatures, right? They're rats. They're using their behaviors based on instincts and stuff like that, right? Whereas the researcher comes in as subject. They have a subjective aspect to the work that they're doing in a research lab. Maybe like, why did they come in to research rats? Why did they come in and do this? And blah, blah, blah. But that's not, I don't think that fully encompasses the entire idea of subject, which is you've emphasized it really well. Subject to, I think the to is really important, because the word subject comes from like feudalism, basically, where you were subject to a lord on the land where you lived. Unless you were one of the, I don't know, the royalty or something, but even then you're still subject to somebody else. And I think that word too is important to this understanding of subject.
Definitely important to it, I think, as well. So one of the ways that I think about this, and this is kind of maybe hearkening back to the graph of desire, which we mentioned in our previous episode, because there was that great video at Lacan Online about how to kind of like work your way through this graph. The subject, one of the things that I equate with the subject of the statement is the ego, right? A person's identity. The subject of the statement is, you know, I am a professor in front of a class telling them there's going to be a test on Wednesday, right? So there's this identity. There's this thing that's making a statement. There will be a test on Wednesday. That's my ego making that statement. That's the identity that I kind of inhabit that is making that statement right there, right? And I'm subjected to that statement. However, in addition to that, there is another part of me, which is not my ego, which is my subjectivity, which is my subject. And that part of me is always going to also talk whenever I make statements, just not directly. And it's going to reveal something. It's going to reveal more than I intend to reveal. Mm-hmm. You know, so like, for example, I could be like, okay, so there's going to be a test Wednesday. You know, make sure that you're ready for that. In that, there, the way I was kind of trying to illustrate it, there would be this idea that I'm saying that people aren't going to be ready for it. Like, you're not taking this class seriously or whatever. Now, I didn't come out and say, you're not taking this class seriously. Come on, get with it. But that might have been something that a student might have detected. You know, they might have detected that subject of the enunciation, what my subject is saying as opposed to what my ego is saying. And and the thing here is they have a subject too. And so what's happening in any communication, right? There's like the sort of like the text, right? The subject of the statement. I say this, you hear that, and maybe you say something back. But there's also this subtext, right? Which is, I say something and you, and it means something in addition to it, right? It's kind of haunted by this subject of the enunciation. There's kind of this more here than what I say, and you pick up on that, and then you say something and there's more in your response than what you say too. So there's this sort of like a lot of times in books now, intersubjectivity is talked a lot about in books about psychotherapy and about psychoanalysis. And that's kind of what that is, I think, right? It's the subject to subject, subtextual sorts of communication that is happening mm-hmm. All the time whenever people are communicating with each other. Which is I think a really fascinating way to think about it, right? Where our subject is the result of the fact that we are subjected to a social situation which has expectations, and we to some degree want to comply, and to some degree probably don't want to comply with those, and all this is happening at the same time. And as a result of that, we of course say things, we make statements, but in our statements are these enunciations, which are what we say but we don't mean to say, what we reveal mm-hmm. even though we didn't anticipate or mean to reveal it.
Mm-hmm. That the way that you put it makes me think, again, about the subject to the enunciation and the statement, because there are two sides to this coin, right? Consciously, all we want to produce sometimes, maybe, probably not all the time, but certainly sometimes, is the statement. We don't want there to be any extra content behind it. So when there is unconscious, latent in our speech, we're subject to the enunciation. And at the same time, in the example that you gave with your girlfriend saying, "I wanted you to pick up on the enunciation," and all you picked up on was the statement, she wanted to express this enunciation, but was subject to the statement because that was what she produced. So even, you know, whichever level it is that you're trying to operate on, whether you're trying to make a statement or trying to lace some subtext into your speech, you're subject to one or the other or both.
As you say that, one of the thoughts that comes to my mind is that I want to say this the right way. So I was having a discussion, this is fairly recently, with another kind of like person who's in the Lacanian world. He's not a therapist. He's a scholar of Lacan and of kind of like just French structuralism generally. And we were talking, I'd mentioned that we were going to be doing this episode to him, you know, about the subject of the speech and the subject of the enunciation at some point. And he was like, we got to chatting about it. And what he said is whenever anybody makes a statement, right? Like they will say, "I don't want to eat junk food," right? That's a statement. He was saying one of the ways that he thinks about the subject of the enunciation is the, what is it that doesn't want you to eat junk food? Or what is it that wants you to eat junk food in that thing, right? Because when somebody's saying they don't want to eat junk food, like there's this idea perhaps that they really do want to eat junk food, mm-hmm. but they're resisting the urge to do so. So what is it that wants to eat the junk food, mm-hmm. right? Who, what is it that is enunciating what is being enunciated is a question that he finds really fascinating. And I was like, that is actually a really cool way to think about it, right? So we got to talking about some other ways that people would mention this. And he told me a story about somebody who he knows who said that they hated a particular team. Like they were talking about sports, and this person's like, "I hate that team." And his thing is like, that's really interesting. What is it that hates the team, right? Mm-hmm. There's something here in that. There's an enunciation there. And he thought that was a good way to kind of get into it. So I don't know, I kind of like work my way through that in a really clumsy way. Does that bring anything up for you?
Yeah, the translation from Freud's ich to ego, I think sort of makes something drop out. Something drops out in that translation. So you had talked about the subject of the statement being the ego. And what I think the loss in translation there is the I, right? The "I hate that team," or "I don't want to eat junk food." So if it's not I, if it's not ego, if it's not ick that wants to eat the junk food or hates that team, then what is it, right? I think that's what you're trying to get at here. And the translation there from the German ick to the, I think it's Latin ego, sort of obscures that a little bit.
Yeah, I think Lacan kind of tries to account for that in the difference between the ideal ego and the ego ideal, right?
Right.
So hopefully I say this the right way. I think it's the ego ideal, which is kind of like the projection that we're kind of putting out into the world. And that's the ideal ego that is like the ego that is sort of endorsed by the other. Does that sound right to you? Or am I reversing those?
I think you've got it right. I reverse them all the time. It's easier for me to remember it as the capital I brackets capital A and lowercase I brackets lowercase A. That makes it easier for me to keep track of because I mix up the words all the time.
All right. Well, hopefully people who are listening are well enough acquainted with the Lacanian shorthand and stuff to understand where we're going. But I don't want to get too deep into that just in case people aren't kind of into it. But I do think that that's kind of an interesting way to look at it. So like the subject of the statement, and the way I guess I think about that, the subject of the statement is the part of us that is subjected to this idea that we have to say things, we have to say them in a certain way, and we have to say them at a certain time, or else we'll be, earning the ire of the big O other. We'll be in trouble if we don't say things in this particular fashion. And that's the subject of the statement, right, that does that. The subject of the enunciation is the part of us that is actually saying, without saying it. It's weird. It's like it speaks without speaking, but it's saying the thing that is more honest in a sense. Which isn't to say that the subject of the statement is totally dishonest. It's just look at that. I just did a huge negation there. wild. But anyways, I guess what let me reset here. The subject of the statement is what we say, and we have an agenda when we say it. You know, like I say to somebody, I want this to be this way, and whatever. Like when I, to go to my favorite example, I go to Starbucks, I order something, there's a subject of the statement, and when I'm making that statement, I would like a venti cold brew. I do want a venti cold brew, right? The subject of the statement is accurate. The subject of the enunciation is also present, though, in different things, right? And it might mean, like, the subject of the enunciation, if I'm in a hurry, I might be communicating, like, you better do it, give it to me fast, or something like that, right? Or if I'm just, like, I have all the time in the world and I don't care, then the subject of the enunciation will be, like, whatever, take your time with it, or whatever the case may be, and that will come through in some way, shape, or form.
You pointed out the negation that you made, and I, as you say it the way that you just did, I wonder if maybe it'd be more accurate to say that the subject of the statement doesn't lie, because like you said, you do want a cold brew coffee, right, when you go to Starbucks, but maybe what it does is obscure the enunciation, right? Like you want to give, when you're in a hurry, you want to give the impression like, I would like this cold brew coffee and I would like it like as soon as you can get it to me. But you don't want to get caught saying like, hurry up, you're being too slow, hurry
exactly.
up and make it faster for me.
Yeah.
You want to disguise that in some way so that your statement is still sanctioned by the big other.
Perfect way to put it.
You can still communicate the enunciation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is solid. Like, great way to put it. Yeah, in that example, the thing I don't want to say is like, treat me like I'm important, and like my time is really valuable or whatever. Like, I'm an important person. Do you know who I am? Or whatever. But that's kind of, it could come through despite the fact that I'm not actually going to say it, right? In the subject of the enunciation.
Right.
You know, it's weird as you say that, it makes me think, sometimes I think there are some things that are truly just the subject of the statement, or for all intents and purposes can be treated as such. Like if somebody says to me, like, what time is it? I think they probably want to know what time it is. And you can tell them that. Now, maybe there is a subject of the enunciation in that, but they want to know what time it is for a particular reason, and that's the subject of the enunciation. But the reason I bring this up is I want to, the point I'm going to try to make here is that in everyday sorts of like interactions with different people, I think, even though I practice psychoanalysis, I deal with the subject of the statement all the time, right? Like because you have to, I think, right? You make a statement, somebody makes a statement, and you just sort of like treat it as a statement. You don't necessarily try to tune into the subject of the enunciation. When you're doing psychoanalysis, on the other hand, I think in that particular practice, what makes it so unique and so different than you know, just like talking to your friends or your family, is that the analyst is actively attempting to tune into the subject of the enunciation, is trying to sort of like, I guess, listen for it, pay attention to it, and then do something with whatever that subject of the enunciation is. You're probably not going to get that in your like regular day-to-day interactions with different people, even people who know you really well, your friends, your family, et cetera. So a lot of times I guess people have said to me, why go to psychoanalysis? Why not just like read a lot about psychoanalysis and then have conversations with your friends and whatever, whatever. And I think that part of the reason for that is that, psychoanalysis is one of the perhaps only areas where somebody is going to pay as close attention as they possibly can to the subject of the enunciation in a way that you're just not going to get outside of a psychoanalytic experience. Maybe you could get it outside of that experience. Maybe there are other ways that I'm not thinking about, but that's one of the things that kind of makes it really important. And tuning into the subject of the enunciation, to harken back to one of the things that we say a lot, is a principle, right? Like that's something that makes psychoanalysis what it is. And again, that's not something like, if you pay me more, I will listen to the subject of the enunciation more, or I'll be able to do more with it. It has nothing to do with if you're in session and you make a statement there's a subject of the enunciation in your statement 5 minutes into the session versus you don't make it until after we've been talking for like 3 months. All that stuff is decoupled from it, right? Mm-hmm. This is something that you're always attempting to do. So anyways, that was a lot of like kind of just like bang, bang, bang idea fired all over the place. I made gun motions with my fingers. People couldn't see that, but I did.
I could see them, Neil.
Yeah, you could see the subject of my enunciation in my hands.
I can.
Anyway, what do you think about this? I've talked too much. You say something.
Oh boy. Let's see. I there were a couple of things that ran through my mind as you were saying that. One thing that came to mind is that something that I've struggled with a little bit, probably less now than I did at the very beginning of doing therapy, is that, so you mentioned somebody said, why don't you just, read about psychoanalysis and then talk about it with your friends and stuff. And so two different things here. Number one, not a ton of people, certainly a fair number, but not a ton of people are super interested in talking about psychoanalysis, which is what makes this podcast super great. But then also, people don't, your friends and your family, I don't think most of the time want you to have the analyst aspect to you, I guess, turned on all the time. There's a difference in these two different relationships where you're an analyst in one setting, but then you have to switch that up when you get home and see your family or your kids or whatever. I remember we've talked about this before. I've accidentally, it was not a conscious effort on my part whatsoever. I've accidentally applied some psychoanalysis to my wife in the past, and it does not go well. It never, ever, ever goes well, because that's not what she's looking for from me in those instances. And it demonstrates why the relationship that you have with your patients is different than the one that you have with your friends and family. I think it tells us something about why, like what that difference is and why it's important that there is a delineation between who you have as a friend and who you have as a patient. Like there's nothing wrong with either one of them. They're just different relationships that require different things from you.
That's fascinating. Oh my gosh. I didn't even think about that, but that's so good. Because of course, like, I mean, the way I described it, I'm now realizing, I think made a mistake. And it was this idea that like when I'm going through my day-to-day life, like I'm never tuned into the subject of the enunciation. It's just like statement stuff all the time. And I think I'm less tuned into the subject of the enunciation, but I am, steeped in psychoanalysis in the way that I'm steeped in psychoanalysis. Like I do it. I do it regularly. So of course it bleeds over into my regular life. But what you point out, which is so great, is that can actually create problems, right? When you,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's like people don't want necessarily in everyday speech, right, to have somebody kind of like tuning into the subject of their enunciation. Like that can actually make them irritated and frustrated with you if you were to do that. But of course, like you describe, I do it from time to time as well. And it, sometimes it gets me in trouble. you know, I'm kind of lucky. I think the person who I happen to be romantically entangled with, married to, is somebody who understands like the importance of psychoanalysis to me. And so like, mm-hmm. I don't remember the specifics of this, but I remember one day she was telling me a story about like one of, somebody who she knows. And she was saying like, you know, and it was funny, like she was saying they said whatever, but the point of her story was that the subject of the enunciation, what they really meant was in fact like very different than what they were saying. And I was like, the subject of the enunciation. She's like, yeah, the subject of the enunciation. And, we had that in common in that moment, which was really cool. But, there have been times where like, she's also said to me, like, I don't want to hear about that right now. Right now, let's just have a discussion at the level of the subject of the statement and let's have it be that, you know,
yeah.
Like, when are you going to do that or whatever the case is. And like, let's do it that way. Right. Don't talk to me about my affect and, you know, whatever, but like, just tell me a straight answer. Will you get to it by Friday or whatever? Like, something along those lines. So.
Yeah, you don't want to be quite so purposely enigmatic in those interactions as you do when you're in the clinic, when you're with a patient. You don't want there to be, probably not always, but in general, you don't want there to be quite as much enigma. You don't want to be this, I don't know, this specific type of figure in those relationships. You want to occupy the space of a different type of figure.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this is one of the other things that happens to me a lot. So I'm getting a lot of, it's in the end of a semester right now as we're recording this, where I'm actually doing this in what is the final week of a semester at the university where I teach. So I'm getting more email than I normally do. And a lot of times it seems to be a thing that people start emails with more now than I've ever seen before, or maybe I'm just more sensitive to it. I'm not sure, but they say, I hope this email finds you well. Every time somebody opens an email that way, I read it as, I don't give a damn what you're doing in this instance, you know, or how you actually are feeling. Like, it doesn't matter to me a single bit. You are just an object that I'm going to make a demand of right now. That's how I read that. And I read it that way every time, even if the person, perhaps they actually are like, I hope you're in a good spot, dude. But I don't read it that way. I always read it as the subject of the enunciation, which is like a slap in the face, right?
Yeah.
It's like this, somebody tries to start an email politely, but my reaction to that is like, you're being so rude to me. What's the deal with that? Like, what did I do to you? I guess is how I read it. I don't know what that matters for this conversation, but I think it's funny.
It reminds me when I'm at like at a store and I need some help from somebody who works there, I always say the same thing before I ask them the thing that I need to ask them, which is, I'm really sorry to bother you. And I think it makes it clear that obviously I'm not that sorry to bother you, because otherwise I wouldn't have bothered you. I wouldn't have taken the time out to go over and bother you, but I need to cover over the fact that I'm bothering you with this statement of, I'm really sorry to bother you.
The enunciation is,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm a customer, service me now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't actually care what you're doing. I don't care if you're taking a break or if you're busy or you're with somebody else. Just, I'm sorry to bother you, but do the thing that I need you to do. It's funny. Mm-hmm. That's what you made me think of as you were talking about the email.
Yeah, that'll happen though too. I mean, we're everybody's remote right now, but it's often when I'm in my office, people will come and they'll be like, they'll say something like, "I hope I'm not bothering you," and it's like, okay, like on some level, sure, you probably don't want me to be mad at you for bothering me, but I hope I'm not, like, it doesn't really matter that much if you are, if you're not, does it, right? You have a thing, right? And it's important. It's like me, like in the coffee example, being like, you know, hurry up and give me my thing. Do you know who I am? Like, it's like that's what's in there and those things in the subject of the enunciation, right? You know, and that's interesting, because that's the kind of stuff, again, we repress that, right? Like, we don't want that to be who we are. Mm-hmm. We don't want that to be evident about ourselves, but it's there. It is influencing us. Even we're subjected to it no matter what.
Right. And that makes it hard to to get around the I'm sorry to bother you, or the I hope I'm not bothering you, or the I hope this email finds you well. Like, there's no perfect way to get around the fact that you feel there's some sort of compulsion to do it, but it never quite says what you want it to do, right? It never quite completely fills up the statement, I guess. I'm having a hard time coming up with the right word, but it doesn't express exactly what you need it to express. Mm-hmm. And that's fundamental to the whole process. You want it to, but it can't.
Yeah, totally, totally. You know what this is making me think of? This is weird. This is like a somewhat potentially embarrassing statement that I'm about to make. By saying that it's potentially embarrassing, I'm attempting to make it not. See what's going on here. Some pronunciation everywhere.
Rubbing my hands in glee. I can't wait.
So before, again, everybody was like having to stay at home all the time because of COVID-19, I liked going out and doing work in public, like generally at Starbucks is where I would go to work. And when you do that a lot, as I did, and will probably return to doing when I'm allowed to, you there's other people around you. And sometimes what will happen is I'll see people and I'll be kind of like, you know, just you notice them, you know, and then like you forget about them, then you notice them again. I'll notice that people are on what seems to be a first date, a Starbucks first date. Right. And that makes sense. Right. Starbucks is a good, like when you're doing internet dating or whatever, you just kind of want to meet somebody and make sure that they're not, I don't know, like a totally crazy person, or, you don't want to invest a lot of time or money into it. Right. Like you're taking a chance. So Starbucks is a safe bet. So you'll see people on these dates and, sometimes I'll eavesdrop on the conversations that are going on. And it's interesting because you're seeing people trying to present themselves in a really particular way. Thinking about like the subject of their enunciations in the conversations that I'm eavesdropping on is a fascinating thing to do. Ultimately it's really wild. The other time that I will do this, and I don't have as much of an opportunity to do this now, but, sometimes like I'll be, so like at the university where I work, if they're going to make if there's a search for a professor, they're going to hire a professor or something like that, they have search committees, and you might be somebody who's on a search committee. And if you're on a search committee, there's other people on the committee, and you'll interview people. You'll invite people to the campus you'll do a phone interview, and then you might invite them to the campus, and you'll meet them and talk to them. And interviews are another example of where it's really fascinating to kind of like recognize that people are making statements and that there is an enunciation haunting so much of what they're doing, but everybody's really polite. And generally speaking, they don't talk about the enunciation.
Right. No, we said before, the conclusion we came to was that, maybe we didn't actually come to this particular conclusion, but when you were talking about your wife saying like, put the psychoanalysis into a box and talk with me on the level of the subject of the statement, like to some extent we recognize the obfuscation that the statement makes on like subjects the enunciation to, but we want to ignore it a little bit sometimes. Like we want that obfuscation to stay there and keep the enunciation inside a box so that we can operate on the level of the subject of the statement. And, you know, I'm sure there are times where operating on the level of the subject of the statement is probably necessary. Like if you want to, build a house, you probably don't need to focus very much on the subject of the enunciation between the people that are building the house. You want to operate on the subject of the statement. Like we need more wood, we need more nails, like blah, 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 whatever it is. But then that's what makes analysis different, right? Is that you switch from the operating on the statement to operating on the enunciation.
Yeah. Or maybe it's to say that the enunciation figures more into it, right? Than it would in normal.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
I think so.
Sure. Because as we've also said, you can't get to the enunciation without the statements in the first place, right? You can't have the enunciation and not have the statement.
Another way that I tend to think about this thing, to build on what we talked about in our previous episode, the one right before this one, I think a lot of times the subject of the statement is very much a demand, right? Give me my coffee. How are you doing today? It's nice weather we've been having, whatever. Like you're making a demand, perhaps not an important demand, but a demand to have somebody respond to you in a certain way, which matches up with the social protocol. Like that's mm-hmm. what's going on there. Where the enunciation has something to do with our actual desire. And when you transition people from demand to desire, what you're potentially attempting to do is get them to tune into their own enunciations a little bit more and to become perhaps more interested in and acquainted with what it is that they really want in a situation or a series of situations, their whole life. Who knows? That's the idea there. So, you know, I think we were going to talk about this in our previous episode about the transition from demand to desire, and we ran out of time. But that's how I see them fitting together, right? The subject of the statement, in my mind, correlates very much with the demand, and the subject of the enunciation correlates very much with the idea of desire, idiosyncratic desire, what a person really wants, and that's really important in getting people to make the shift from demand to desire is also a really important thing in psychoanalysis. And you may not want to do that in... If somebody's trying to plan a move and they're asking you to help them, you don't need to do that. And that's kind of a situation. But in the psychoanalytic situation, that would be the place where you would engage in this project of kind of divesting from the demand and a little bit more of an investment into the desire.
Mm-hmm. I made this little note that you reminded me of as we were talking back and forth about this. I think it's probably pretty common understanding that you don't know what a sentence means until it's over with. Like that seems pretty cut and dry. It seems pretty obvious. So then the question becomes, what does psychoanalysis add to this? What does Lacan add to this in his conception of the graph and his other theories in psychoanalysis? And what he adds to your thought here is desire. There's no desire in the statement. So what Lacan adds by demonstrating the two sides of this coin of speech is the desire that is illuminated by the enunciation. I think you're right that there's no desire present, or at least there's very little desire present in the statement. It's demand, whereas the desire isn't known until after the speech has ended, and you can go back and examine the speech that was uttered for desire, for enunciation.
That's a really good point, right? Like I don't want to make it sound as though like down with demand, because that if we get rid of demand, then we never have a way to kind of like tune into the desire, right? The demand, right. You get to the desire kind of through the demand, I guess. Somebody comes in, they make a demand, they have a demand, fine. You're not going to necessarily, if you're an analyst, gratify that demand, but you are only going to be able to engage with their desire as a result of the demand that they make, right? So a demand is an essential component mm-hmm. of the analytic experience as well. It's not something that we can just kind of like get rid of or fire, like get it out of here. We need mm-hmm. that to be there so that we can eventually do the work of trying to maybe make somebody have a different relationship with their desire.
Right. In seminar 10, I think it is, and in various different seminars, but I'm thinking of a specific passage in seminar 10 where Lacan formulates desire. I think it's the barred subject with the, I can't remember, the diamond shape. What the
last lozenge.
Yeah, there you go. And then demand, capital D for demand. And in this passage from seminar 10 that I'm thinking of, he specifically says, the way I've taught you to read the formulation for desire, subject, lozenge and demand. And then he says this really, really interesting part of the sentence where he says, subject cut of demand, right? And what that says to me is what you were saying before, that there is no desire without the demand. It's from the cloth of demand. It's part of and separate from at the same time of the demand. Like it exists alongside the demand, even as it's separate from the demand. The desire is, I should say, the desire depends upon the cloth of the demand in order to cut it out, even as it's separate demand itself.
There's a lot in that. And because that seems like a gigantic box, I'm going to recommend that we stop here.
Okay, fair enough.
Mm-hmm. So quick, just one short announcement before we wrap up today. We have a new domain name. We have bought a domain name for the podcast. It is theinform.org, theinform.org. It used to be on a subdomain for my personal website, inform.neilgorman.com. That will also still point to the website for a while, but we now have a shorter one. And we have some plans for that website and what we're going to be doing with it in the future. So check it somewhat regularly, if you don't mind. That would be really cool. And having said that, I will say, you know, this is Neil. This has been the Informed Podcast. Thanks for taking the time to listen. Jared, you got anything you want to end with?
Meow.
Perfect. Take care.
Bye, Neil.